right, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to a brand new edition of the Bluminati podcast. I'm your host, Nathan Bond. Joined alongside me, Seth Varnador. Last time I saw you was at the spring game. It was definitely a game that happened, and the halftime alumni game was by far the most interesting part about the football played. It was a good night. Capacity crowd. They had to turn people away. So that's a good step in the right direction for head coach Alex Golish as we head into the 2023 season that is rapidly, rapidly approaching, Seth.
Yeah, it was a fun night, fun event. Like you said, really, really good turnout. We'll see. We've got some film to possibly watch later. That's there's some good stuff, some bad stuff, but that's to be expected with spring. But I think probably the bigger news seems to be kind of the transfer portal. You had a lot of guys from USF go in after spring. And they're starting to turn it around and kind of get some guys coming back to them here. So,
yeah, absolutely. And let's jump into that. And then we're going to, we'll say this. I've already called an audible. Let's get into the transfer portal stuff. We'll talk about the spring game. And then toward the end, we're going to discuss what women's golf was doing in the NCAA tournament because this is massive. And we're going to have the talk about USF baseball. So you have that to look forward to later on in the show. But let's jump right in. I will say, you know, head coach Deion Sanders continues to be such a benefit to USF football, even long after he's gone. Okay, so he gets the stadium, you know, basically built for us. So big shout out to him. And thanks to his brazen use of the first year get the F out of my program rule that the NCAA has instituted, USF has kind of really snuck under the radar while using the exact same get the F out of my program conversations that have been had over the last couple of months since spring ball started and finished up here. The Bulls saw a pretty big exodus, and we kind of figured it out that it was going to be the case. Roster turnover is just going to be a thing nowadays. In the Discord today, we kind of went through basically from 2016 to 2021, how many people came in from high school and stayed throughout high school. And right up until 2020, it wasn't great, and then just kind of fell off a cliff. But mostly because of the extra COVID year, the laxed transfer portal rules. So this is kind of what you've seen over the last few years is kind of the culmination of guys not either panning out or just leaving the program entirely. But Seth, let's get a rundown real quick on who has left, and then we'll discuss who has joined. And please chime in the comments if I've missed anyone. Because boy howdy, there's been quite a bit. Let's get right into it. The first transfer out was Eddie Kelly, which was the day of the spring game, if I'm not mistaken. Clyde Pinder, who I guess he's gonna figure out how to go to class. So good for him. He's officially in the portal now. Devon Hicks, I think, is the first one to find a new home. He is transferring up to UConn. Gunnar Smith, the forgotten child of the 2022 recruiting class, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah.
A quarterback. Yeah. Him and Byron Brown came in together.
Byron, yep.
So the forgotten kid, I mean, I know there's a story in The Athletic about the Deion, maybe not knowing some of the players' names. Gun to my head, I would say it's a 50-50 shot. Alex Golish knew Gunnar Smith's name.
Now, I thought, you know what? I thought he made some really good throws in the spring game, too. But he was one, as soon as they started recruiting Israel Carter, you thought, okay, this is probably looking at a scholarship quarterback leaving, and could Travis Marsh kind of going to be declared like he's not ineligible, right? Because they brought in quite a few quarterbacks, it felt like, right? So this was one that, if you were in the Discord, this is something we've kind of thought might happen for a while. And like I said, I think he made like the throw of the game this spring. He made a couple nice balls, but
well, aside from Blake Barnett hitting Andre Davis for that long touchdown in the alumni game, that was an incredible pitching catch.
There were some rockets being thrown in that alumni game.
Pat Jewell Miss still's got the heater is really what it boils down to here, folks.
It's embedded in somebody's chest from 5 yards away on the goal line.
Oh, my goodness. We should really do a film breakdown of that game. That's what the people want to talk about. So followed up after Gunner, DaQuan Stanley, who was a corner, then turned into a slot receiver, battled injury. He did have his Rysheem Bronson moment, one really, really long touchdown, and that is it. Deontay Hunter, who was a pretty highly touted guy coming out of high school, you know, a mid three-star, had an 85.78 on 247. He is now in the portal, and his offer list is underwhelming. If you follow him on Twitter, for how highly recruited he was,
I was going back and kind of looking at his recruiting profile when he jumped back in the portal. I mean, there were guys that were doing like, these are guys you need to know in the G5 as recruits, guys that might blow up, and he was the guy that was listed. I think he's from a really good high school program, and for whatever reason, it just didn't. So yeah, he's from Lowndes in Valdosta. For whatever reason, just didn't turn out. I think he was kind of a tweener. He's really like an edge rusher, but he came in at like 195 pounds, so he's probably not quite big enough to be that edge rusher right now, and he's also probably not twitchy enough to play linebacker. So he's kind of stuck in between where. He needs to put on some weight to become that edge rusher guy, but maybe he just couldn't do it. So we'll see. But yeah, that was one that was kind of surprising just on pedigree. And so was Eddie Kelly. It was the same thing. Kind of, you know, we'll see where he ends up. Maybe he made a good decision for himself financially, but I don't know. I haven't seen kind of where he's been offered yet. So we'll see.
No, I did see on three. They're tracking Troy and Coastal for him.
Yeah, that wouldn't be a big upgrade.
So,
maybe
Summerall seems
success. Yeah, Troy would be a good spot, but
I know Coastal's restarting.
Georgia Tech. Somebody said that would be. That'd be a good spot.
That's a nice little reset there. And then following that up, A.J. Hamilton and Jordan Blackman both enter the portal. A.J. Hamilton, along with Chris Townsell, were two guys 2 years ago who got a lot of run, and then we just never saw again, either due to injury, lack of faith from the previous coaching staff. It was pretty startling to see, you know, T-Mac Simpson, he had a great play in the spring game. He had a pick six. I think he did something. I think he had a couple sacks, if I'm not mistaken. But he was at the time kind of a guy from Eastern Michigan. Who is he? And he just kind of leapfrogged both of those guys for playing time. Jordan Blackman just never really saw the field. I think he was also kind of a tweener as well. Not really sure what he could be on the field. And then Clemson transfer Ray Thornton. Just got hurt, couldn't stay on the field, and then as well as Clemson transfer JoJo, who got hurt and couldn't stay on the field, and Alex Golish, I think probably never really said it out loud, but you could tell whenever he was asked about a JoJo during spring, he's like, "Yeah, this is the guy who, you know, this is what you want your wide receiver to look like. He just needs to get on the field." So,
yeah, there were some coded messages, not, you know, heavily coded, but there are some messages, I think, in the media from Golish on some of these receivers. And You see quite a few of them have transferred out. So that's a position that needs a bit of an overhaul, but there's some help on the way.
Yep, there is. So that's kind of the and forgive me in the comments if I've forgotten anyone. It's the sites that track transfers are not great at the G5 level. So on three, not much. Rivals, literally nothing. And 247, not as frequently updated as we would all like. But on the flip side of that, Alex Golish was able to turn this roster over, and he's going to turn it over continually. And I think there's about 5 to 6 spots left from what I gathered. If you're in the Discord, Sean mentioned that he spoke with some folks around the program, and it's less than 7, more than 1 in that area. So there's no visits this coming up weekend. I think I know for basketball, it's a dead period. I'm not quite sure if it's also a dead period. Like, you can't DM, you can't like anything, you can't.
There's other schools that are having guys on campus.
Okay, so maybe it's just this kind of weekend. Yeah. You know, I get it. But they have able to pick up a few guys, probably positions of need, and being able to get these guys because the positions USF needs, offensive line, wide receiver, defensive line, those are always kind of going to be the positions that all of the schools need. So you're kind of trying to fight for the best ones. And they were able to, you know, they landed a big dude. I think he's the latest one. Lindell Hudson, the FIU transfer offensive lineman who, just going off a 247, he was a low 2-star coming out of high school, and now he's a higher 3-star. He jumped from a 77.31 to an 86 on the dot. That's a big jump coming out from high school to being a transfer. He's got 1 year left. He's got, 30 starts under his belt? That's something that USF needs when you're replacing 4 guys who, along the offensive line, who had 25 plus starts along the offensive line. Now you're rebuilding with, you got Donovan Jennings, but he's coming off an injury, and you're trying to figure out everything in the framework of this particular offense. But having a guy with that veteran leadership who, I mean, 6'7", 320. That's a big dude. That's a,
yeah.
If he's not going to be your left tackle, he can be a solid right tackle for you.
Yeah, and I think if you go back and watch the spring game, if you go back and think about it, it seemed offensively the spots where you did not have a lot of depth were offensive line and receiver. So those are two positions they've addressed in the portal. Starting with Hudson was a guy. There's another one we'll talk about here in a second, but. Both those were spots where you felt like your two deep's probably not quite there. Now, receiver, they held a lot of guys out. Golish said after they didn't want to risk a freak injury to one of these guys just because their numbers are pretty thin already. So there's a lot of receivers that got held out of the spring game. But those two positions, receiver and offensive line, were ones where they needed some guys. So it's good to see them address those positions in the portal.
Yeah, absolutely. And following up on that, you know, Jaden Alex, receiver from Texas, comes in. So, you know, wide receiver in, wide receiver out. I think we kind of need to make it kind of clear here. USF's not going to land the guys who are transferring with a lot of production belt.
Did you guys know? Yeah, for a second. We lost you after their belt, under their belts.
Oh, okay. Yes. Okay, well, to be fair, I did stop talking there, so maybe you didn't.
Oh, maybe I didn't.
But yeah, you're not going to get the guys who have, you know, 50-plus catches.
No, there's the guys that are super productive that are, like, transferring up are... You know, there's some guys that are just going strictly for NIL. What can you do on the NIL front? And I don't think USF is super competitive on that front just quite yet. And then there's also the team success front, you know, NFL production front. And I think that's something that Golish is going to have to prove out and hope that some of the Tennessee guys that got drafted this last year hit for him, because that's one of the big criticisms of this offense is, does it get guys ready for the NFL? So in the receiver front, I guess in the quarterback front as well, but you can come in and put up a bunch of numbers, but I think it's going to be difficult to get the most desirable guys that aren't kind of bounce back guys just because due to the NIL game right now. So you're kind of in a tough spot. You're trying to find guys that, for whatever reason, have those, maybe hasn't worked for them, but they got the physical tools and you can kind of take swings on them. And it seems like that's what they've gone for with a couple of these guys.
Yeah, absolutely. Another wide receiver that they got from Minnesota, Mike Brown Stevens. We're just going to call him MBS. 5'11", 195. Seems like a slot guy to me. If I'm not mistaken from his time, I know
he has had some production.
Probably the one highlight of him is that drop that turned into a pick in the end zone.
No, he actually had some production. He had some decent games. He was not crazy highly used. Yeah, the first if you like look at him on Twitter, the first thing you'll see is a ball that kind of is a little bit out in front of him and it hits him and it pops up for an interception. But would you like to hear some interesting trivia on him?
Always.
According to 24/7 Sports, his uncle is John Legend.
The John Legend.
Says John Legend uncle. I don't think there's a lot of John Legends out there.
Yeah.
So, there you go.
I don't think so. Wow. Look at that. That's pretty cool. And then along the offensive line, as well as Hudson that we mentioned, Zane Herring, transferred from Florida State, interior lineman there. Always need depth help there. Emmanuel Hickman from ECU, he's an edge rusher. Andrew Matafa from Utah as a linebacker. And then one that we know for sure and literally not listed anywhere is the TCU defensive lineman. What's his name?
Douglas Blue Ely.
Douglas Blue Ely, he's a 300-something-pound defensive tackle.
Yeah, I think he's a nose tackle, I believe, a bigger guy, if I recall correctly. But, yeah, just some more beef up front.
So you're telling me he's Terrence Cody. That's what I heard.
I don't think he's quite that big.
So he's Terrence Cody, got it.
But hey, we're putting some big bodies down there on the line.
So hopefully that 300 plus pounder
listed as 6'2", 320 by TCU.
Buddy, there if that doesn't appease the masses for we need 300 pound defensive linemen there. You did it. We did it.
There you go. He was a, prior to TCU, he was a junior college All-American. He didn't play a ton last year. He played in four games, preserved his red shirt, but was a Juco All-American before that. So,
was he the one that was at Butler?
No. I'm not sure where he was. Let me look. He was at... Monroe Community
College. Okay. Gotcha. So that's kind of all the transfers, ins and outs, at least so far. It's May. I know the portal was closed last week, if I'm not mistaken.
In April, I believe. And then you had like a couple day period where if the schools drug their foot on paperwork, but.
Yeah, you have 48 hours. Yeah. Schools have 48 hours to actually submit the paperwork. So, got a couple more in there. So, we kind of know what the plan is for USF. I think they still want to address defensive line a little bit more.
DB seems to be another position they're looking at.
Yeah, the one that kind of surprised me. I know they brought in Mataafa, but we discussed it on the Discord earlier this week. Linebacker still seems a little shallow for the most part, and I think that's a little interesting that they haven't. Again, another one of those positions where it's like, man, does everybody need a linebacker or something? It's interesting to me that they haven't maybe gone after, or we haven't heard about other linebackers that have either started talking to USF or try to make the jump. I know they have it too deep, and they're only going to go basically two in-box linebackers.
Yeah, so. That's what I think they're going to play. I think it's functional. I think it'll be called a 3-3-5, but it's functionally a 4-2-5 in my mind. The third linebacker or the fourth defensive lineman is kind of a hybrid guy that'll drop into coverage and rush the passer, but that'll be like a Lloyd Summerall type guy, which is more of a pass rusher, not so much as like an in-the-box backer. So I think most of the time they're going to play with two backers. So, you know, kind of looking through it, I think with Mataafa, as I always say, Mataafa, right?
Yeah.
With him, it looks like they have about they have about six guys for those two spots. They're six scholarship guys. I think obviously you probably want more, but if they're only going to play two at a time, you have kind of a three deep. But I think they'd probably, I think at this point, there's positions they want to hit, but then also take anybody they think is an upgrade on the roster, it seems like. When Golish talked after the game, I thought that's kind of he said it's not necessarily like best player available, because I don't think they can always get best player, but he seemed to kind of think there was really no positions outside of quarterback that were off limits, is what it sounded like to me. Did you get that same impression?
Yeah, and I mean, he was kind of directly addressed the quarterbacks, like, I love what the quarterback room is right now. I don't think it's going to get touched. But everywhere else is pretty open and fair game for improvement. And I think we saw that. Jason Albritton also entered the portal. So walk-on wide receiver, I think there was a bit of a redundancy with Dominic Canella also on the roster. I think that, and Dominic Canella has had success at the college level. He's rushed for quite a bit of yards and a bunch of touchdowns. What was it? At North Dakota State? North Dakota State. That's redundant at some level.
And in the spring game, kind of on the field beforehand, Albritton was kind of practicing with the H-backs and the tight ends a little bit more than the tailbacks. So maybe he's just like, hey, I'm not an H. I'm not like a H-back guy. I'm going to go transfer somewhere and I'll be a walk-on, but I'm going to play tailback. So he goes to Ole Miss where Cam Akin, I guess, and a couple other, you have some staff members from the last couple years there with Charlie Weiss Jr. there as well. So there you go.
And if Cade Fortin can get into an SEC game, why can't Jason Albritton?
Cade Fortin threw a touchdown against LSU last year.
Also that.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. I think you might be on their wizard on that one.
Yeah, that's probably also accurate. So there's one kind of thing looming, and it was mentioned earlier, and I want to make sure that we do address it. I think the time after the spring game until you get to summer workouts, much like in the NFL, you don't want to be the story. Running back Mikey Dukes was arrested last weekend for domestic violence with strangulation charge. He was booked Saturday morning. He was released Saturday night. Charges are still pending. The official USF statement is he has been suspended from the team indefinitely while the process plays out. From the police report, it's not great. There was choking, alleged choking, spitting on his, I guess, girlfriend. They'd been, I guess, dating for a little bit, and ripped her shirt, left bruises, things of that nature. Somewhere around 3 o'clock in the morning, 3 to 7 o'clock in the morning, and the old Herm Edwards adage, nothing good ever happens after 1 a.m., rings true here. I do want to be clear, as the facts are presented, we will update you guys, much like we have in the past with other incidents of this nature. I think even today, you know, the punk god Matt Ariza was seemingly cleared of all of his alleged rape charges after he got signed with the, after he got drafted by the Bills and was named the starter. This story comes out and the prosecution, everybody said he wasn't even there when the alleged rape happened. And he lost his job, he lost his livelihood, things of that nature. So it's tough to, at least for our end, to discuss this without saying, hey, truly innocent until proven guilty, but this is what's happening. He is off the team currently. He's still listed on the online roster until the things play out. Now, I think everybody will remember the Kayvon Dingle incident at USF, where he was arrested for basically the same thing. And the charges were eventually dropped and he was kind of proven innocent. And the thing that the media, I'm going to honestly toot my own horn here. This is like one of the first like big scandals, because we had the back-to-back right after Charlie Strong was hired. We had Ladarius Jackson, who by all accounts is seemingly a serial rapist or very close to it. And then we also had Kayvon Dingle, and we had the judge basically before Charlie Strong and even coached a game at USF calling for his firing based on incidents that were taking place and addressed almost immediately. Kayvon Dingle was proven innocent, but he never really got back on track collegiately, and it's tough for our side of things to be level, because on one hand, man, these are terrible. I wouldn't want, you know, I've got a 6-year-old daughter, a wife, like I don't want these things to happen. But also on the other hand, like, we got to make sure these things are actually happening, as borne out by literally the matter is a case coming out earlier today, like, hey, this didn't happen, or at least he was not there, and anything that did happen may have been consensual with the alleged victim. And don't want to the victim shame or what have you, but we just want to be as safe on our side as possible to make sure we don't overstep what we know or what we think.
And on the USF side, like, they have to kind of the same track, right? You can't just come out and kick a guy off the team immediately. You got to let it play out. So I think when we all read it and we all thought, hey, if this is true, you know, kick the guy off the team yesterday. Like, let's get this over with. But you got to let it play out. So this is something that'll take time. You know, I've heard of situations in the past where things like this happen and, you know, the coaches want to take action, but the school was like, hey, you can't do anything until this plays out a little bit more. So this could be a thing where, you know, maybe even, and this has happened in other places I've heard about from guys there, that like, you want to kick a kid off the team, but you really can't, cause you don't want to open yourself up to any type of lawsuit if you are incorrect. Right. So you're just hoping that, the process plays out quickly and you get, all the facts out there, and then you can deal with it when those come out. So
correct. And it also helps that Mikey Dukes is good at football. because there was already an earlier incident back in February where Bailey Purcell, a walk-on wide receiver, was arrested for solicitation of prostitution and was immediately kicked off the team. It helps if you can't be a walk-on and mess up. They will absolutely kick you off the team with no regard. If you're a guy who scored 5 touchdowns and is going to be your leading returning rusher this year, they're going to wait to see how things play out. And that's just the facts. That happens at literally every school. You see what happened at Alabama. The basketball player literally was playing games like 3 days after he went and handed a kid a gun who ended up shooting and killing a woman. So this is what happens when you're a good athlete at any level. And them's the breaks. I don't know what else to say about it. Without overstepping my bounds, I just know those are the facts as presented right now. We will update you as more comes along. And I swear to you, if USF becomes embroiled in a gambling scandal, I am going to laugh my effing head off, because we all know there's no shot any USF team or player is actually going to be good at gambling unless they're gambling against themselves. And then it makes all the sense in the world why these teams suck.
A little point shaving.
So we'll see. I hope they've made thousands of dollars if they end up being in the scandal, because the pain that it would cause. But moving on off of that, let's do this. Seth, can you cue up some of the spring game footage and let's kind of take a look?
Can I? Yes, I can. All right. Let's watch the first drive by the first offense. So maybe down the line we'll do more, but let's just watch the first drive here from the first offense and just look for here's some interesting things and here's what makes the offense tick. So here you got your tight end split out really wide. You're going to see a little bit of short motion, and just it's really hard to deal with, especially when you get in stacks. Because if you're in a stack, you can't exactly walk this guy up, right? You don't want to play 2 guys in line in a stack. It's a tough move. So right here, you motion to a stack. What are you going to do? Makes it an easy read. You just block this guy, and now you're getting him the ball right now in space one-on-one. Probably with some run game called, but that's easy. Pick up 5-6 yards on first down. Second down, you go to a little trick play here. Defense does a pretty good job covering it up here. And defensively, so you've got, right, this is basically a 4 front. You've got the tight end over here. You've got basically a 3 technique. It looks like he could be a 4-eye shaded tackle, but I think he's on the guard. He's kind of between the guard and tackle. So he looks like a 1. So this is a normal, like, 4-2 box. This isn't anything crazy. So even if you're a 3-5, that's why I say it's functionally a 4-2-5, because they can bump down into even fronts here, or they can play odd front where you got a guy on the nose, which they will play in this game a little bit as well. So good job here by the defense. I thought the linebackers, Schuler, I thought he really kind of flew to the ball quite a bit. It'll be interesting to watch this year. He's got had a really good film, right? He was the guy that was just smoking people on like junior college tape, right?
Yep.
And he didn't.
And he was smoking people at this. He was smoking the spring game last year too.
Yeah. So you'll watch. He runs around a little bit. So the camera work was also kind of in spring practice as well. So we missed some plays here at the beginning, but you can see here, quarterback pulls it. This is an RPO, but just look at basically here's a tight end. I'm guessing he was split out. Double slant, but look at all the space now. Basically, you got from hash to the sideline one-on-one. So it's really easy. If you have guys that break tackles at receiver, you know, you're basically one-on-one with a safety right there. So this is why what the offense does. Look at all the space you have here to throw this thing. So nice conversion there. And then there's a lot of easy throws built in offensively here. So they'll package stuff up. So I think up here you've got like a now screen. The corner's off. He's just going to run a simple hitch, and then you've also got run game in here. And this is a play I love. You're going to run a counter, but it's going to be from the same side. So he's actually going to stall for a second and become the second guy. So instead of bringing him across, which you will see later, where they have, and this is something I'd love to ask Coach Goulish about, where they figured, how they figured this one out. A lot of times you'll have this counter here. He kicks out. He's wrapping. A lot of people do that. You'll notice here it's from the same, the tight end's actually on the same side here. The H is on the same side. So it's really interesting. Really makes it a tough look, I think, defensively. And then if you like it here, because look how much separation you've got, rip it out, throw the ball out there. Again, if you've got a really good receiver down there, and you got one, your corner's continually one on one. And we saw that kind of last year against Alabama. They continually got guys one on one at Tennessee against safeties and things like that in that Alabama game, and were able to shred them. Same thing. I think there's throws attached to, I'm guessing they have throws attached to just about every run. See, I think your tight end kind of misses on the backside here. But they're giving room to the slot. Just to throw it out there. Good tackle here defensively. And still basically in that even front look here. Basically a 4-2. Here's the safety walking up. Playing maybe cover three. Some not too much crazy stuff. Split zone. Good job sending two off the edge. So they started doing this quite a bit where they'd slant.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have two off the edge there.
If I'm not mistaken, the pick six is off of basically a nickel blitz.
Yeah, it's something similar to this.
Yeah, basically just, I think, on the opposite direction.
Yep. Yeah. And then they try to pull the RPO at the end, tips it back, and then the blitzing safety is right there for it.
So there was, you know, some inventiveness. There was some stuff that they did during the spring game that is exciting. And you just got to think, you know, Kelly Joyner started playing slot the Tuesday before the spring game because of so many injuries. Naeem Hines didn't play, Choffrey Brown, Seth Jones, so on and so on. So my hope, my guess is with better people at those positions, those one-on-ones become, you know, one-on-zeros where you break that, because your entire goal is, right, catch the ball, break that first tackle, and then try to cause chaos. I think with skill guys, and you got to build them up, that's what this offense can present itself with.
Yeah, it was really like, it's with the depth at receiver for the game, with all the guys they held out just because they knew our depth's not great, we can't afford to have a guy tweak an ankle or something. You didn't really get to see kind of the full look, and they didn't show a ton either. But so here's one. You're trying to get the tight end pop here. I think you got this. This one's probably forced a little bit. This one's probably been there all week in practice or all spring. Tight end gets pushed here and doesn't quite get out clean, and then you try to force the pop. Later on, and maybe this will be something we look at later on, in the offseason, you get the pop there, but you almost throw a pick. You got to be careful. Probably, if you don't like that, you come in here to this guy. But I think the defense was able to play a little bit aggressively because they knew they didn't really have any guy that could beat him over the top, really. They had, you know, Joyner probably was the only one. So that changes the way you can play defensively. If you can play a lot more top down and aggressive. I mean, look right here. This is, you know, you got one deep. Everybody else is, you know, playing downhill. Get a screen there, about pick it up. I think this is going to be something they did a ton of, but motions, formations, and screens, and that was the end of the first group offense. So there was some good stuff in there, and we'll probably go more in depth later on, kind of maybe a separate all by itself, because it's
like
a lost time to really get into the nuances. But you know, going back and rewatching it, there's some good stuff. I thought Byron Brown, going back and rewatching, was a lot better than I remembered in the moment. I thought he was fine, but you know, he's a guy that I was like, okay, he's making pretty good decisions for the most part, and he was able to, even without them being able to run a ton, he was able to pick up some yards with his legs and do some good things. So the lack of receiver depth, I think, tilted the game a lot in the defense's favor.
Right.
So I'd be interested to see what it looked like kind of full on for both sides. But you did see the defense is going to be aggressive. So I think you got to see a little bit of the defensive style. They didn't really show a ton on either side, but you did get to see how they're going to play stylistically, at least.
Yeah, and I agree. I thought, you know, outside of the pick, and there was, did Byron have both interceptions? Was that Archie?
I think Archie had both.
Archie had both. Okay, so the first one, just bad rotten luck. I think there was a missed block. Yeah. Or of that nature, and it just kind of fell into T-Mac Simpson's hands. The second interception is something that gets you benched forever and a day.
It just missed an open guy. He did a really good job waiting to throw it in like a second window. It was like, oh, this is good. And then he missed him high.
Logan Berryhill comes over, makes the interception, the converted wide receiver that this staff is pretty high on heading into fall camp. So we'll see if you know, winter and spring translates into fall camp. We've seen in the past guys who pop during winter or spring not really make it past winter and spring, Elijah Mack. But we'll see how that goes. There's one big date looming large for USF football right now. It's the post-grad kind of camp that they're running in June. So it's like a little less than a month away. So it's postgraduates, JUCOs, portal people, kids in the portal. There's a massive camp going on. They've got multiple camps going on as well throughout the summer with some big schools coming in. I know our pals over at Western Carolina will be down for one of the skills camps. I think Tennessee, I think Ole Miss, some other ones are also going to be down for the camp. So, you know, that's the best way to attract, you know, high-level talent, but also, like, you know, their friends who are pretty good and, you know, just need a little bit more exposure, and that's where kind of USF swoops in. You know, I think we need to get out of our heads that we're ever going to snag the top guys. If USF ever snags a top guy, I think there was something, I think it was leading up to the NFL draft or something like that. If, you know, a guy falls, there's probably a reason why he falls. And it's the same kind of premise for college players. Like if a guy, you know, commits to a P5 place and then ends up, you know, he's committed early and he ends up at like a G5, there's probably something along the process that, lowered him. So yeah, he had offered, he was committed to X school, but there's probably something going on. See Stacy Kirby, right?
There is one guy out there that might buck the trend there.
Who's that?
Jonathan Echols. We talked about him briefly in the Discord, but he had he's been committed to Tennessee, plays at IMG. He wants to play tight end in college. 24/7 Sports has him as the 124th player in the country, 7th athlete in the country, high four star, or 92. So in the composite, he's a 95.58, 89th player nationally.
I think that would be the second highest recruit in USF history. behind Ryan Giddens out of Armwood in 2009.
And I bring him up because if you have a 24/7 sub, you're sub to kind of all the 24/7 sites. So Florida's 24/7 site was talking about Jonathan Eccles. And they said, let me pull it up. I put it in the Discord yesterday, but here's what he said. Eccles has been committed to Tennessee since last summer, but the door is still cracked to schools like Florida, USF, and Alabama. And then later on, he went on to say he's talking about getting an official at Florida. And then Tennessee and USF are others mentioned, or other mentioned official visits for June. So there you go.
There you go. Let's buck the trend here. That'd be a freaking get and a half, man. They've got to be biffles. They've got to have like bracelets, matching tattoos, something.
Yeah. He's been, I think some schools wanted him initially as an edge. His recruiting profile says he kind of was looked at as an edge, but he wants to be a tight end.
Correct.
So, goalish. What position did he coach at Tennessee?
I don't know. You tell me.
Tight ends.
How about it?
Yeah. So I think they've got a good rapport, and now that he's in IMG, I'm sure. It seems like the staff is going to make IMG a priority, which is smart, right? There's plenty of guys right there that you can get to. Very interesting. He's got an 81-inch wingspan, and according to Andrew Ivins, he has NFL upside. So
that'd be a pretty good get.
That would be good. Projection as a Power 5 starter.
Look at that.
So, would be interesting. So he's the guy that would be give him the Lambo.
It was a Corvette, guys.
We'll give him that. Give them both.
Yeah, find one. Who cares?
Figure it out. But yeah, so that's an interesting. I think what'll be really fun to watch going forward, if one of those Tennessee receivers or Hendon Hooker can do something in the NFL, that would give a lot of credence to the offense. And if they're able to kind of put together a couple good years here, I think they'll be able to kind of recruit at a high level at the skill positions. But a couple of things have to break their way, I think.
Yeah, Jalen Hyatt's got to be a guy.
Yeah, if him and Cedric Tillman both have really good rookie years, they can sell that. So
yeah.
And then have a guy like Jaquan Smith come in and play really well as a freshman, which I think he's going to play. He's running consistent 10-4s out there. I think he's playing this year. So.
And he does, I think it's the triple jump or long jump. Those two always confuse me. They almost seem identical, I'll be honest. But a boy's got some bunnies.
I saw a kid that was not super athletic to like some D3 in Ohio because he had like our long or triple jump record or something like that at the high school, but like nobody ever did triple jump really. I'm like, this kid's got the triple jump record. And the guy's like, holy cow. And they brought him in. And the guy like barely played for us. So recruiting fairs are always fun.
Yeah. So that kind of wraps up the football portion, and I see the viewers just absolutely crater. I will say this: stick around. I'm going to touch on baseball, but we got to give some love to USF Women's Golf. They made their first NCAA tournament since 2012, and believe me when I say this, women's golf has gone through some shit in the last decade that would make a whole lot of people blush. And I will say this, for everybody who thinks this website, this blog hates USF, I assure you we don't. because the women's golf thing never got out. Now, I've talked about it, but overall, no one really knows or really talks about what happened with the former coach for women's golf. So
yeah, I don't know.
Exactly. So what Erica Brennan and Dawn Stevens have done over the last, I guess this is what, year five now, of the uprising is nothing short of remarkable. And they just finished the second round of the Palm Beach Regional. They're tied with number 10 ranked Texas for fourth place at 13 over par. The top five teams in each regional advanced the championship rounds of golf. And they've just been steady. I think only one team finished under par today. I think the course played a little bit harder. I know Lenore Ryan?
You thought you were talking about a girl. Lenore, I know Lenore.
She posted a 369 today. Melanie Green is just keeping pace. She's tied for fifth after two even par rounds at 72. So she's literally doing what goats do. And I will say this once again, she's the best women's golfer USF has ever had. And it's not particularly close. She's already going to break her scoring average for a season and for the year, like for a season and then for her career. Like, she's blown past it. I think she's going to finish the season scoring average a full stroke better than she did last year, which also set the program record. Like, she's insane. They've done really, really well I think it's Palm Beach something. Palm Beach.
The Palm Beach
Country Club?
PGA National?
I can't remember what the course is. Oh, yes, at PGA National. Yes, sorry. They've just been really good. They've been steady. You can see on the screen here, if you're on the stream, they're what, three strokes back at Central Florida. So they've got some cushion going into tomorrow.
Got a two-stroke lead on six, and only one stroke out of third. So,
yeah. So it's very possible that they can maintain. And like, you look at like Quinnipiac, like
what are they even doing? I'm like,
but here's the thing: like, their worst score, they shot like an 84. So like, they, like, if you think you're a good, they would smoke the absolute dog shit out of you. Just know.
Yeah, Melody Green's in 72-72. That's pretty good.
Oh, this, these guys are way faster than me. They're whatever. But then, like, you, when you play like a sport recreationally, like golf, and you're like, hey, I mean, you know, I shoot like, you know, low 90s or 95, and then you're like, oh my God, look at these scores. No, they would still absolutely smoke the shit out of you in golf. Like, no questions about it. Don't even think about it. It's probably the biggest gap in talent that you could have. Like, you may luck into a curveball. There's no shot you're beating a golfer.
I was watching this video with Joel Damon. Do you know who that is, Nate?
Yeah, he's a really funny guy from Full Swing.
Yeah, he was in there. So he was talking about, they're doing a video, him and a guy that writes for a golf magazine, and they basically, like, the writer would play Damon's drives and Damon would play the writer's drives. So they're just talking about, you know, when did you know you were pretty good? And Joel Damon said when he was four years old, he shot a 48 from the ladies' tees for nine. And he broke par for the first time when he was like nine.
Good Lord.
It's like a whole different type of person.
Bro, I played
people that are good at golf.
I played Countryway, which is like a par three, like you know, small course off of Waters and like West Chase or whatever, Town and Country. Last Wednesday, I shot like 20 over par. Like I shot what these girls shoot like on a bad day at a full course.
It's a tough game.
God, I'm so bad. But that I just want to bring that up. Final rounds tomorrow. They wrap it up. Top five teams make the cut and go to the championship rounds. It'd be a massive, massive step in the right direction for women's golf. So of all the extensions Michael Kelly's handed out over the last few years, Erica Brennan's one that's definitely absolutely earned it.
So does Melanie Green have a chance to win the individual?
Yeah,
I think she's pretty close, right?
Yeah, I think she's four strokes off
or back
leader, which is, you know, pretty good.
Here we go. I'm playing.
Yep. Where is she this year?
Yeah, tied for fifth, just like the team. But yeah, four strokes back. Miami's has somebody that's two under in both days.
So
she's within striking distance.
She is just a bad day from the top. And go from there. I will say this. It's as a terrible golfer. I played the same course in back-to-back weeks, and I played worse the second time. And I think it was because I hit this awesome shot last week. I can just do it again. So that's the one thing these athletes can do is block out or at least do better than I can, block out what they did yesterday. But I still have to approach the shot completely differently than I did the previous day.
Yeah, they're very good at course management. And that Damon guy, the same thing he was saying, we practice so much and we get out on the course, we're just kind of playing, we're not thinking about it. Whereas most amateurs are screwing around on the driving range. And then when they get out, they're really concentrating on every shot when they're actually playing. He's like, it's kind of the opposite for really good golfers. So. And then that hurt my feelings. So,
all right. Next up, it's the conversation I've kind of been dreading having. I'll be honest. USF baseball. What the actual F? What the F? You are wasting one of the most exciting offenses that you've had in years with the worst pitching I've seen since that 2016 team was terrible at pitching because they had 45 injuries. Shane McClanahan tore had Tommy John in the ramp up to the season, and then a bunch of guys got hurt. It's horrific. I just want to read you some stats for this team real quick. And it's startling. So offensively, I'll give you the positive. Team's hitting .272, which is pretty dang good. All right. Their OPS is .794. They've hit 62 home runs as a team. They've done really, really well offensively. Here's the bad. Opponents are hitting .288 against USF this year. An .856 OPS, and they've hit 67 home runs. This team, it truly, truly does not make any sense. They've given up what was that score? They gave up 25 runs to VCU. On a Sunday, and then on a Friday of the same series, they gave up 18. They gave up 16 to Houston, 11 versus Central Florida, 14 against Florida Gulf Coast, 11 against Cincinnati, 10 against Cincinnati. It's brutal. And here's the thing: I think the last two weekends are probably these past two weekends where they got swept by Cincinnati and they got swept by Memphis is all right, there's something really wrong with baseball this year. And probably over the last couple of years. And I think if we really, really want to look back at it, outside of that truly magical 2021 run where, you know, they ended up winning the conference, they won a regional, they went to a super regional, it's been pretty mediocre. We're in year six under Billy Moll, and I, much like Brian Gregory, love Billy. He's been fantastic. But in year six, you can't be worse off than you were 3 years ago. And you see what Mark Kingston's doing at South Carolina. The guy who brought in Billy Moll to USF, he was the pitching coach during a very fun time at USF for baseball, 15-16 and 17. And then two regional appearances, and then he takes a South Carolina job. And Mark Kingston wasn't great at South Carolina early on, but they stayed with him, and now they're a top 10 team in the country. And USF has not seen that progression. I will say this. Yes, Heath, I was literally gonna bring that up. Dartmouth are 3-36. They were like 1-27 up until, like, they were 1-27. Like, that, there was a point where that USF win was the only win Dartmouth had up until, I think, the last two series. They took one against Brown and one against someone else. They were horrific. You can't continue to do this. And it's same with men's basketball. You can't be in year six and seemingly have gotten worse. Now, the USF men's basketball offense was fun this year. You know, shooting threes, you know, Tyler Harris broke a record. Drew Brescher's been fantastic. Eric Snow's been great. But you can't pitch. The thing that you were brought in to do initially, you're not bringing in the right guys. And they have not progressed probably like you thought they would. And we're at a crossroads now with this program where you can't be 6-12 going into the final two weekends of the season and staring last place in the face. You can't do it.
2-8 in their last 10.
It's been brutal. And those that Cincinnati series and Memphis series, I looked it up, put it in the Discord the other day. Cincinnati's had one winning record in the last decade. Memphis has had two since they joined the AAC in 2014-2015. Like, these are not teams with historically great baseball programs that you're getting beat by. You know, your Tulanes, your Houstons, your, you know, Wichita States, ECUs. These are the teams you're supposed to pad your record by, and you got swept by both of them.
Yeah,
bruh.
Cincinnati's last in the conference in batting and pitching, it would seem.
Like, you cannot freaking do that and expect to, you know, keep your job. You've got to pull off something. You've got to sweep. You got to close out the season. You're 18-31. You've got to get as close to 500 as you literally possibly can. You got to steal the conference title. You got to steal a regional bid. Otherwise, Michael Kelly's going to have a really hard decision to make. And I mentioned it when Jeff Scott got fired. Okay, worst case scenario, you fire your football coach, you fire your men's basketball coach, and then you fire maybe one or two Olympic coaches. And we are staring down the barrel of that. And I don't see, like, anything, nothing. I don't know what the drop dead is, but you can't go 0-2 in the conference tournament and expect to keep your job. Them's the facts. You can't be, best case scenario, I think there's, what, 9-ish games left? I think there's two weekend series and then two more, so what, 8 games left? Say you go 500. And those, you can't go
seven.
Okay.
Three at Wichita, home against Stetson, then three against ECU.
So seven. There's not a game today. There wasn't a game today. No midweek this week.
No, it looks like May 12th, according to the schedule.
Okay. Wasn't sure. So seven. You can't be, what, 21-34. And then go 0-2 in the conference tournament and end up 21-36 and expect to keep your job. Like, if we're going to be frank here, I think the COVID year probably saved Billy's job the first time. They were 6-11. They looked absolutely horrendous in 2020. season gets canceled, you kind of get a reset and you go to the, you pull off a miracle of all miracles. So that's kind of where we're at. It was kind of the elephant in the room, and much like women's golf, I will bury as much crap for baseball as I possibly can. They're my first beat. I love them. I love the staff. I love Billy. I love Mark before him. Like, those are my guys, but you got to start freaking winning. And he knows it. But you got to start winning, otherwise you're not going to be here much longer. And each passing day, those department-wide extensions look stupider and stupider from Michael Kelly.
Yeah, I think he'd like to have that one back.
Thank God for Eric Jenkins and Erica Brennan. Holy cow! Man,
nice gesture. I was under the impression that none of it added buyout money, but then there was some that wasn't true. So, yeah,
it's a tough look.
Very nice. And maybe that's one of those things that, like, hey, you break even later on when you hire another coach, you know, not this time, but maybe the next time. You know, somebody's like, you know what, I don't work for that guy. It's during the pandemic, he gave everybody an extension, even though they weren't doing very well. So, you know, maybe it pays off down the road, but yeah. If you're adding buyout money on those do not look great in hindsight.
No. So that's my baseball spiel. I feel terrible for the kids who, like, especially offensively, like, this has been such a fun year. Eric Snow's been incredible. Bobby Bozer, I think at one point homered in like 7 consecutive games. He's been great. Drew Brutcher, I think, is now in the top 7 all time in career home runs. Like, it's been a fun offense. The pitching has been non-existent. And that's the frustrating part, because, Pete Strzelecki is now like a shutdown guy for the Brewers, which, you know, Billy helped mold. Shane McClanahan, 7-0 for the Rays. He's a, you know, Cy Young runner-up, all-star game starter. But Billy knows how to coach pitchers and bring them in. I will say this, like, NIL's probably changed a little bit. Being able to just get drafted, I know he's lost a few arms to the draft over the last couple of years. It's kind of taken a pounding, but I mean, he had to deal with that previously. That 2016 class had like 8 guys who got drafted. McClanahan, I think he was like a 15th round pick. Garrett Zek, who ended up out of baseball after his USF career, he was like an 8th round pick. He got those guys to campus. It just, times are changing for baseball, and it's adapt or die time. And he's already fired his assistant coaches before. I don't know if you get to do that twice, and depending on those guys. So I don't know.
Yeah, that's you can only go to that thing one time.
Yeah. Typically. So we'll see.
All right. Well, I think that's
it. That's
just
it.
About everything.
That's it. It's 11 o'clock. I'm tired. I'm going to go relax. I appreciate everybody tuning in for a new episode of the Bloominati podcast. It'll be on your podcast feeds eventually. Seth, thank you as always for doing this, jumping in, being flexible with my sound and music rehearsals that I've got. Be sure to check it out June 2nd to 24th, Friday, Saturday, Sundays at Carrollwood Players Club. Carrollwood Players Theater, something like that. Anyway.
The Players Club sounds even better. Yep.
Well, we're at
it. Got it. So.
All right. Be safe. Make good choices. Have a good rest of your week. Go Bulls.
Go Bulls.